small talk about resumes and shit. Want to go for a ride, you say, and if you mean that you're going to go for a ride on my dick, then yes. But instead, you take my hand and lead me onto the escalator. It is crowded and sweaty and Christmassy, and I would rather be balls deep in a trash can. There is no privacy on an escalator at Macy's in December, but you're a little performer, and here you go. So my grad school advisor, the one on sabbatical who's on a grant at Princeton, and you pause as if the Mexican chick in front of you cares. He wants pages before we break, which is obviously ridiculous. What's his name again? I say, even though I have never asked. Paul, you say. You don't offer a last name, and the conversation is over, thank God. We get off at the fourth floor. It's loud and smells like pretzels and perfume. A Miley Cyrus song plays, and it's too hopped up in here. Loud skanks picking fights with each other assault my senses, and I ask you if the headphones are on this floor, and you tell me you need to return something. Fortunately, the line at the young sluts department isn't that long, because most young sluts can't afford to buy shit. As it turns out, you weren't telling me the whole story, and when it's our turn, you pull out leggings and a wrinkled receipt out of your bag, and the poor girl behind the counter has never done a return, and of course, we have to wait. Is there a reason this is taking so long, you snip? Well, you bought these more than 100 days ago. So? And holy shit, you really are broke, because why else would you be digging up pants from 3 months past? You grab the pants and the receipt, and you shove them in your bag. I'll just come back when there's a manager. Fine by me. You are stung now. You were depending on that refund. You take it out on everyone in the young sluts, plowing through rayon and neon without saying excuse me. A couple of bitches say they want to kick your ass, but they won't. They're in high school. They are happy just to call you a biatch. I tell you to slow down, and you don't listen. And I almost love what a cunt you can be, because one of these days you're going to tie me to a bed and slap me and lord over me the way you lord over all the people who get in your way. You're so revved up, and I want to play with you, and I do. Beck? What? Look, I don't know shit about girls' clothes, but those pants that you were trying to return, they look good. They don't look good on me. Can I see? You fight a smile, but you lose. Here? Yeah, I say. And you're walking more slowly now. And there's nobody monitoring the dressing room because it really is Christmas, and Santa knows I'm a good boy. We walk down the corridor of dressing rooms toward the handicap one on the end. You don't tell me why you're pushing that door open, and you don't invite me into the room, but I follow. I sit down on the bench, and you stand in front of the 3-panel mirror. You pull the pants out of your bag, and what is wrong with you that you're still thinking about pants? You sigh. See, what I really want are jeggings. But what you really need is an orgasm, and I tell you to try them on. You are blushing, naughty, and a door slams, and someone's muttering, "Get a room!" And we did get a room. We have this room, and your furry boots are off, and you're unzipping your jeans, and they're so snug that when you pull them down, your panties start to go with them. Come here. Joe, shh. I motion for you to come here. Because you are shy at heart, you pull your pants up and even start to zip them as you walk over to me. I look up at you, and you look down on me. And you start to crouch down and reach for my belt buckle, but no. I grab your hand, firm. Stand up. You do. And when I start to unzip your pants, you step closer and wiggle and help me get you out of those pants, and I get you all the way out of them and throw them at the mirror, and finally, at long last, in the young sluts department of Macy's in Herald Square, Christmas comes early. I taste you. I lick you. And when you come at the top of your lungs. I love shopping. Sex clears the mind and the orgasm agrees with you. We leave the dressing room and you decide to give the pants you were trying to return to your mother. I knew we were never getting any earmuffs. You hold my hand hard and tight and we ride the escalator 4 flights back down and you do not want to browse anymore. The music softens as Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas begins, my favorite sad holiday song. You ask me what I'm doing for the holiday, and I tell you that I'm working, of course, and you tell me that you're gonna have to get a job. You lead me into men's hats, and you pick a red and green wool monstrosity, I shake you off. Maybe I can work here, you smile. You could come visit me on my breaks. Do you really need a job? Instead of answering me, you pick up a red hunting cap, like the one Caulfield wore in The Catcher in the Rye, and you look up at me. Please? It's pretty much my favorite book of all time. I can't say no. And I love you for not mentioning the book by name. I put the hat on and you bite your lip. Adorable. It's hard to get you to take me seriously while wearing this ridiculous hat, but I try. Seriously, Beck, do you need a job? You are too hot, you squeal, and you take out your phone. One picture, Joe. You have to let me get that for you. I better not see that on Facebook. You're not on Facebook, silly, you say. Smile. You take my picture and I give you the hat and you dig in your bag for your credit card. Beck, I say, you don't need to buy me a hat I'm never going to wear. Seriously, do you need a job? I know I don't need to buy it, you say. I want to. It's Christmas, so I let you buy me the cap. And I say I'll only wear it on one condition. Anything, you say, and you have gorgeous tunnel vision. Tell me you'll take a job at the bookshop. Yes! You cheer and you throw your arms around me. I give you everything you want, everything you need, and you kiss my neck so softly, my lips tenderly. You murmur my name, Joe. And everyone walking by probably thinks we just got engaged. Later in the day, Ethan shows up for an interview. I don't have the heart to tell him that the job has been taken. He looks like a gerbil, and he's friendly as a puppy, and he'd be better off in an animal shelter than a bookstore. He talks a lot, and I check your email, and it's clear to me that you called Peach and told her about our shopping excursion and your new job. She writes, Beckalicious, I hope you're not beating yourself up after the Target romp. Remember, doing something trashy does not make you trashy. You're only human, little one. Just please be tender with him. Probably not the best idea to work together. Maybe better to work on campus? Anywho, be well, Peach. The email from Peach kills my Macy's buzz. What if you back out on me? What if we work together and we don't get along? What if you need to have a hashtag girls night on your nights off and I never get to go shopping with you again? Ethan would never bail on me. He brought 3 copies of his resume. You seem awfully busy, Joe, he says, perky. If you want me to go, I can come back in a little while. My day's clear. I buy time. I don't know if I can deal with his energy. What are your 5 favorite books? He smiles like I just told him that Santa Claus is real, and I read your response to Peach. Oh, it was Macy's, not Target, so that's more respectable. I hope, and you're right. I know, I shouldn't work at the bookstore. I am so bad about boundaries. Why are you always so smart? Ethan is in the middle of his analysis of The Lord of the Rings when I interrupt him. I'm sorry, Ethan, just give me another minute here. You don't have to be sorry, he sings. You're the boss! Everything is an exclamation point with this guy, which is why it's puzzling that his favorite book of all is American Psycho. I love a good scare, don't you, Joe? I prefer literary fiction, and he wags his tail, and I refresh your inbox and open Peach's response. I just care about you, Beckalicious. Remember, boundaries. Also, I feel like I haven't seen you in forever. I put your phone away and quietly thank your mother for footing the bill. Ethan is still talking about the gerbil in American Psycho. He gushes and giggles, and who the fuck is this guy? I just love books, he chirps. I could talk about books until the cows come home. That's the hardest thing about losing the job and the girlfriend. I miss talking. I love talking. Ethan is the loneliest, most depressing man I've ever met in my life, and at the same time, he's saving me. And he's perfect, just what I need. You will not be into this guy, and next to him, I'm the man. I smile. So, Ethan, can you work weekends? Of course, he chirps, not entirely, unlike a gerbil. I can work anytime. When we stand, I realize that he's almost a foot shorter than I am. He has dandruff, and he gushes with gratitude as I walk him to the door. You know, Joe, I always had this feeling that I'd wind up with a fun job like this. To be honest, majoring in finance was my dad's idea, not mine. Well, that's good, Ethan. This is good, I say, and he is the one with boundary issues. You go have a beer and celebrate. I don't really drink, but maybe I'll put a little rum in my Diet Dr. Pepper, he exclaims, and when I watch him walk down the street, I feel proud, like a teacher. I've done a good thing today. You write to Peach and wish her a happy holiday in the sun. You tell her you're probably going to stay in the city because it costs so much to get to Nantucket, and she responds, Sweetness, if you need a loan, you know I am here. You write back no, adamantly, and Peach is leaving to meet her family in St. Bart's and rub organic sunblock all over her grotesque body and think about you. Maybe she'll find a native girl, fall in love, and let you be. I email you that you start tomorrow, and you respond right away, the right way. Smiley face, yes, boss. Later that night, you call me to clarify your start date. When I tell you about Ethan, you are confused at first. I thought, I got the job, you say. Well, it's the busiest time of the year, Beck. Does this mean I won't get as many hours? This means we might have a night off together once in a while. You get it, and you lower your voice. Are you sexually harassing me already? I don't laugh. Yes, miss, I am. I'm a genius, clearly. And Peach can fuck off because we keep talking like boyfriend and girlfriend. I tell you more about Ethan and you laugh. He's like the anti-Blythe, you say. She crosses out exclamation points in everyone's stories, literally. Damn, I say. I wonder what would happen if they were in the same room together. Oh my God, you say, and I can tell that you just sat up. We have to do that. Beck, we have to set them up. This kid is so innocent, I say. I don't think I can unleash Blythe on him. Honestly, Joe, you say, Ethan might be just what Blythe needs, and vice versa. I mean, opposites attract, you know? Are we opposites? Well, we'll see, you say, and then we move on to talking about Indian food and music, and it's one of those conversations that just flows, the kind you can only have after a dressing room. When we finally hang up, I send you Ethan's contact information for Blythe. I write, Merry Christmas. You write back, It is indeed, smiley face. Chapter 27. I love having you at the shop. Working with you has made me fall back in love with Mooney's Place. We are an adorable couple and a good match, and you love it when anyone says so. There are no more dates. There's just us. You get here before your shifts start and kiss me hello. Dull pedestrian couples get a dog to practice raising a kid, but we have a shop full of books together. We share the load and laugh at the customers and playfully argue about what kind of music to play. And we are one of those 1950s couples, very sexist because I am in charge and you like it that way. You toy with me, bending the rules on a daily basis, and you live to push my buttons. We laugh easily. I bring my Holden hat to work, and I put it on when you're not looking, and you burst out laughing when you see me. Oh my God, Joe, you have to let me take that away. I playfully fight you off. You can't take my Holden Caulfield cap. You laugh. No, what I can't do is let you go out into the world wearing that thing. Clearly, I was not thinking straight when I picked it out. I like the reference to our time in Young Sluts, and I let you grab my hat. I never even took the tag off, and you were pleased to find it there. Now I can get you something even better. And I can't believe how cheesy I feel, how upbeat, but it feels like the world is on my side. It's downright happy in Mooney's Place. Ethan and Blythe are actually going on dates, which is amazing, and I go to bed wondering what you're going to wear to work the next day, wondering when our chemistry will erupt into a marathon fuck session in your bed that I built. We are waiting to have sex because you say this is special. And it is. Every day is Christmas, and today you arrive in a slutty gray slouchy sweater that hangs off your shoulder and transforms your collarbone into a boner-inducing porno shot. You're chomping on baby carrots. I tell you to go home and change. You talk with your mouth full.
You never said it was a dress code?
It's implied.
By what?
You sass. Ethan's baggy sweatshirts? Calm down.
I am calm, Joe. I'm just asking you to tell me about this dress code.
Think of it like school. You wouldn't go to class in this. You toss the carrots on the counter. You cross your arms.
I came from class.
Just cover it up, I say,
And I want to tell you, this is why the guys in your class feel permitted to try and fuck you. Cover up what? You say, and now I want to bend you over and teach you a lesson. Your daddy issues are intense, Beck. Cover your collarbone. Well, why don't I put on your fleece? I let you try on my black fleece, and it drowns you, and I'd like to pick you up by the collarbone and bring you to the F through K section where you went your first time here when you didn't even know what you were looking for, me. And I can do that because I'm the boss, and you want me to do that, and I want to do that, but I won't. I like how much you want it now, and it's going to stay that way. And I shake my head at you and motion for you to get out of the fleece, and you piss and moan, and your slutty sweater goes up along with the fleece when you pull it over your head, and some pervert in reference books is looking, and I reach over and yank at your sweater and pull it down. You startle, and the radiator hisses, and the soundtrack of Hannah and Her Sisters delivers instrumental old love songs, and you brought me a coffee like a good girl, and you hand me my fleece. I take it and sit down on the stool at the register, and you bat your eyelashes at me, and that perv is still looking, and I have to take care of him. When you come back, I say, raising my voice, you better be wearing a bra. You blush and try not to smile, and you slip into your peacoat and grab your bag of shit you dragged in here, and you nod. What color? It can't be long before we fuck, and I shrug. You pick. Red? Fine. Black? Go, I say, and you go, and I look at the pervert and call him out good, cold. Did you need help, sir? No, just looking. Well, if and when you do need help, I'm here, I say, and I turn off the Hannah and put on the Beastie Boys and wait for you to come back, which you will, because you love it here with me. Did I mention that this was the best idea ever? Your first shift, you were an arrogant disaster, and you fucked up every sale you made and overcharged and undercharged and wore your fucking brown university sweatshirt as if you needed everyone to know that you're above this kind of shit. And I told you no sweatshirts, and you turned red because you know when you're being an asshole. The perv in references asks if we have a bathroom, and I tell him, sharp, cutting, no. And he doesn't say goodbye when he leaves, and I take the opportunity to go downstairs and beat one out because working with you and waiting for you to get here so I can smell you and see you and be near you every day has me worked up like a fucking eighth grade kid with a slutty substitute teacher. My phone buzzes and you're fast and you have texted me. Knock, knock. And there's a photo and it's you in a red bra and you text again. Is this appropriate for the workplace? And I write back, no. And January is the deadest month in the world, and I could stay down here reviewing bras all day, and you know it, and you come right back. Knock, knock. I type, yes. And here it is again, you. No face, just your tits shoved into a pink lace bra, and your nipples are hard for me, and I can't take it anymore. And I finish, and you text me again. Question mark? And I refuse to give my dick to you in this way, and you're starting to figure that out, and you text another photo of yourself. No bra. And I give you what you want. I text, bad girl, come here, now. You text right back, lightning fast. Yes, boss. No punctuation, just yes, the universal euphemism for fuck me now, and boss, the universal euphemism for I submit. And I clean myself up and bound up the stairs and find the Paula Fox I'm pretending to read every time you show up, and I take out the Beastie Boys and put on some Beck. It's a regular thing now, a joke we have. We are that couple with a secret vocabulary of songs and books and looks and meals. And by the time you get here, it's almost time to close, and I haven't even checked your email in days. That's how into me you are. And you slip out of your peacoat and you're in a fucking lace, see-through tank top. And you smile at me. Is this inappropriate? I close Paula Fox and the Beck song Sex Laws starts to play. An ode to handcuffs and illogically great fucking. You and I will make our own fucking song. And I adjust so I'm facing you and the door is not locked. And the sign says open and the streets are emptying out a Monday in January. And the Hannah was foreplay and the texts were first base and you moved toward me slightly. And I spread my legs slightly, and you were standing on your peacoat in your fuck-me boots, and I can't take it anymore, and I break. You're late. We're about to close. Sorry, boss.
When do we close, boss?
Now.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I say, and I'm a rock, and you're not wearing any panties under that skirt, you whore. And you tilt your little head and twirl your little hair. And it's amazing how the most generic shit in the world can be so hot. Half-naked girl in a bookstore, reaching for a Twizzler, chewing on it slowly, begging for it, silently.
Well, maybe there's something else I can do for you,
you coo. And I shake my head no and motion for you to come here now. And you have the Twizzler hanging out of your mouth. And you put both of your hands on both of my knees and lean in and dangle the Twizzler at my mouth. I bite it. Finally. Chapter 28. I have just fucked you for the first time in our lives, and it was not good. And it did not go on forever, and you did not scream. Where was that Macy's heat when I was inside you? And who's to blame for our quick fuck? Was it because we weren't in a dressing room or in front of an open window, or was it me? Was I too hungry, too eager? Did I hold you too hard? Maybe I'm better at eating you out than I am at fucking you, and that's a horrible and unfair possibility. We've only done it once. Do I get to do it again? Do you want to do it again? You don't want to do it again. You aren't revving up as we recover on the floor of the cage. You were on top of me, stroking my hair, and I can't see your face, but I can feel the disappointment in your hands, in your touch, which is full of pity. The pads of your fingers go pat, pat, and I can't let go of you, or you might back off of me, and I might have to face you, and I can't do that. It lasted maybe 8 seconds, 9. I'm running it over in my head, and I don't know how this happened. Maybe I jerked off too much, and maybe you teased me too much, and maybe I should have locked the door. No, you said. It's so hot with the door open and the open sign up, right? I should have been honest with you and told you that the lack of security would only make me nervous, but I didn't want to disappoint you, and I wanted to put your needs first. You wanted to go at it by the register, but I said no. Let's go downstairs. Really? You said, and you were lit up. You were. I'm sure of it. We got down here, my idea, I have key, I am the boss, and I unlocked the cage and ordered you in there, and I locked it, and you smiled, and I told you to take your skirt off, and you obeyed, I am the boss, and you weren't wearing any panties, and I told you to touch yourself, and you did, and I willed the other Beck to shut the fuck up. You wanted the music on, and so I left it alone. I am the boss, and I am allowed to please you on occasion. You stood holding the cage door with one hand, and working at yourself slowly with the other while I started getting undressed. And you watched me smiling 1 second, intent and ready the next. I told you to beg for it, and you begged me to come in there, and I took my pants off, and you saw how badly I wanted to come in there, and I told you to get down on your knees, and you did, and you reached for me. I am the boss. I am allowed to please you on occasion. And I unlocked the cage and entered. You took me in your hands and in your mouth. And you kept looking up at me, and I knew it was time to fuck you and let you know that it was time. And you leapt at me, an animal, and straddled me and commanded me downward. I am the boss, and I am allowed to please you on occasion. And then I was inside of you, and I came. I blew it. I came so fast and so hard, and you said nothing at first, and you didn't act like you wanted me to help you finish. You just went smack into gentle stroking my hair mode, the wrong kind of fucking touching, and you quietly told me, "Don't worry, Joe. I'm on the pill." And that was the moment I was most afraid of you, and what you could do to me and not do to me, because that was the moment that I realized that you are the boss, not me, and you can please me on occasion if you want to. When we finally stood up, we were both hungry and dizzy, and there was an old man upstairs standing at the register, and he looked at us, me all dressed, you in your bra, and he smiled. "You kids have a good night. I'll come back another time." There was something deathly unsexual and anticlimactic and flattening in his words, his old man eyes and his pleasure at seeing us, young and hot and alive. He had more fun in that moment than you and I had in our first fuck, and there was no getting around it. And I wasn't surprised when you said you should go check on Peach, because she's been really depressed. I wasn't surprised that you didn't suggest we go to your bed and fuck again. I was bad, and you are the boss. But this is what surprises me. A day later, you didn't even wait a whole day. You texted me. Hey, Joe, I can't make it in today. Sorry. And that exclamation point was the beginning of the end of us, and I made a mistake by writing back, okay. And then you made plans to go out with Lynn and Hannah instead of seeing me. You. I miss you girls. I have an emergency session with Dr. Nikki, but want to get late lunch and or happy hour? Hannah, who is this? Haha, yes, fine. Lynn, I'm already in pajamas and housewives mode, frowny face. Have one for me. So this was it, right? The true end, because instead of seeing me, you were opting to see a mental health professional and a girlfriend to talk about me. And when a girl likes talking about you more than talking to you, well, in my experience, that's the end. So I was gonna fucking kill myself and everyone in the shop and take out the Eric Carmen CD and smash it into bits because I stopped believing in myself and our future. I wrote back to you, pathetic. Okay. It's a good thing you knew that I was close to losing my shit, because not 5 seconds after I shut off the CD, sometimes silence is the best sound, and sat down on the stool and thought about castrating myself like the perv in Little Children, you wrote back again. But what are you doing tonight, smiley face? And all was well in the universe, because that smile was your gaping wet pussy that knew that I had more to give, and I was okay again. It was clear to me now that you were going to your shrink to talk about your problem, that you enjoy sex more when there's an audience. And you were going to see Hannah because you've been busy with me and she's been away on vacation and you wanted to tell her all about the best head of your life in Macy's. That emoticon was your way of saying that we don't work together anymore, we fuck together. So I told you to be at my place at 7 and you wrote back, see you then. It was 7:12 when I realized that the candles were cursed. 5 little votive candles that I picked up at Pier 1 Imports because of some guy in the bookstore who stayed in my head for some reason. He seemed cool, like a guy I'd be friends with if I was on the market for friends, and he dumped a heavy bag on the counter so he could get out his credit card and he sighed, fucking candles. Women and candles, right? Right, I said, and I didn't realize it, but an imprint was made then, and I would never have a woman over without candles lit, because of some pussy-whipped husband buying Tom Clancy for himself and candles for his sex-withholding wife. What makes us become us? What fucks us up and why? I have no idea, but I know that at 7:12 I started to resent those candles and the little pathetic scented fires in each of them. The pizza was cold and the wine I bought, I hate wine, was getting shittier by the second. You can't let wine breathe for that long, and I knew you weren't coming and that it was a matter of time before you flaked out on me, and sure enough, at 7:14, when I was sitting at the table I dragged home and up the stairs for this very moment, when you texted, don't hate me, but I have to bail, frowny face. And that smiley face is your body, closed, and your eyes averted, and your resignation from all things me. From all things us, and I don't need to read your email to know that I can't fully blame this on Peach, because she's not the spazzing dick, that's me, and I put Twizzlers in a vase for you, Beck. I pick up the vase and I throw it at the wall, at the tapestry I bought from an old lady down the street to cover the hole in the wall to make you feel more at ease in my place. The vase doesn't crack. It just bounces onto the couch, and I must be the limpest limp dick in the world. I can't even break a vase. And I lunge at the candles, but I don't want to set this place on fire. You were in this place, and you still fucked me. I cannot hold this place responsible, and I cannot blame the vase or the Twizzlers or the do-not-cross police tape on the shower curtains, and I lower my hand onto a candle, and the fire is hot, and my skin aches, and I'd set my dick on fire if I could, but we know that I'm a limp dick pussy. I don't have the balls to do that. The smell of burnt flesh overwhelms the cold pizza, and it's a good thing I didn't waste any money on flowers. Chapter 29. I'll tell you something about suicide, Beck. If I were going to off myself with a handgun or a noose or a permanent swim, which I'm not, now would be the time to do it. You have dismissed me. And it's been 5 hours and 11 days since you took your love away, and all of our songs sound bad because they will never see us standing from such great heights. And no, you will not still love me tomorrow, because you never love me at all. I'm not Bobby Short, or the real Beck, and you don't want to defy the logic of all sex laws with me, and you are not in love again, and you do not love it. I made it inside of you, and you don't want me back. Nothing is fun anymore. Not even coming up with tweaked out Benji tweets. Coke. Because I'll sleep when I'm dead. Hashtag Coca-Cola. Hashtag ha ha ha.
Excuse me, but can you stop with your phone and look at me?
An uppity old broad squawks. I hit tweet and offer my assistance. The bitch barks.
I said I don't need a bag. I brought my own.
Good for you. I snap and crumple the paper bag and throw it in the trash just to let her know who's boss. And Ethan sighs and apologizes to her and pulls the bag out of the trash, and this is what my life has come to. Me, Ethan, and a bunch of book-buying assholes. I spend day after day with Ethan, and getting to know him is no easy thing, especially now that I don't get to tell you about him. You complained about the loud fan in the employee restroom and pushed me to replace it, as anyone would. Ethan calls it a sound machine, and claims it doesn't bother him. He's almost like a hermaphrodite, this kid, in a CK1 asexual cologne 1992 sort of way. Without asking, I can tell you that he knows all the words to Gonna Make You Sweat, and he'd be at home on a dance floor sidestepping, clapping, and counting, out loud. He's aggressive in all the wrong ways, and he was born too late, and he looks tired at 41 from years of hunting for a color-blocked, Rick D's narrated way of life. You can either feel bad for the guy, or jump him and steal his wallet. He's a litmus test of a person, and half the customers meet his smile and the other half glare at him, and I tell him all the time that he should work in an old folks home, and I mean it. He could DJ dance parties for people in wheelchairs, on life support. People with crooked, chamomile-scented dicks and lazy, warped vaginas would spark to his total, complete, and tragically inherent want for a time long gone.
Have a good one, ma'am!
Ethan, you don't have to call everybody ma'am. I say, some people you just wave, or leave it at your welcome. He won't listen, or learn, or bend, and I'm losing patience with him, with life, with humans. I have nothing left to crave and dream about anymore. I feel queasy when I look at him because he's so fucking nice that he doesn't mention you at all. He doesn't lord his relationship over me, and he says as little as possible about Blythe, which makes me like a pity case. All I have is a shitty memory of our quick sexual congress. Your 8 seconds is a monkey locked to my dick. Every day the hotness in Macy's seems cooler and the sex memories are like all memories, doomed to tarnish and weaken with time. You told Hannah,
I just got too deep, too fast, again.
The again hurt, and it's all perpetually downhill. My days begin with stale frosted flakes and newly ripped jeans I forgot to wash, won't wash. You were on them. I ride the train to work and I don't care about the books because you're not touching them. I check your email ferociously. You go on with your life and you don't write to me. I pick at the scab on my burnt finger. I don't want it to heal and I want this pain, and I tear at my finger that you liked so much that night in the horse-drawn carriage. My finger oozes pus and blood and pain like everything else in my life. If Ethan tells me one more fucking time that I ought to go get my finger checked out and sue the maker of the coffee pot, I had to think fast. You can't tell the new kid on the register that you lit up your finger when you got dumped. Well, if Ethan doesn't shut his face, he's gonna get hit in the face, pus and all. And even though you only worked here a short while, you were a permanent marker on this place. And somehow it feels vicious that Ethan now stands in your place. He likes new things. Crisp Gap merch.
What a great sale!
He exclaims, as if I want to know the story of how he got his discount denim and his button-down shirts.
On Tuesdays, everything in the clearance section at the Gap is an additional 40% off, he informs me, as if to mark my calendar, as if I asked.
And every day, he's in a good fucking mood and clean-shaven and tragically, pathetically hopeful that more good things are going to happen for him. Having Blythe has made him feel like a winner, and he plays the lottery now.
Hey, Joe, maybe we can go in on a ticket together. You know, like you read about in the paper, those guys that work together and win together?
Every day he raves about his coffee as if this is something that needs to be pointed out, that coffee tastes like coffee. And when it's January, the most universally reviled month of the year, and it's sleeting and the sky looks like acid-washed jeans, and the store has to be mopped 3 times a day because of slobs in their boots and slobs with their umbrellas, and he's got to fucking sing out, "Don't you love a gray day?" And when the sun does shine to mock us because it's 32 degrees, he's got to sing out again, "Nothing like a winter sun, am I right?" And the worst part is that he won't hate me, Beck. I can ignore him and bark at him, and he's my dog, smiling every time I walk into the shop. He'd never kill himself either, even if he missed a 75% off sale at the Gap. He's too mild. One day, when he first started, he showed up with a bag from Bed Bath & Beyond. When he went to take a shit, he eats too much bran, worries about his colon. I peeked in the bag. Do you know what was in there? I'll tell you what was in there. A collapsible tray table. Is there any sadder purchase in this fucking world? Maybe a CD of CNC Music Factory's greatest hits, but that's about it. And I remember thinking, Ethan is gonna go home from the shop and make fiber for dinner and put the dinner on his new tray and watch network sitcoms and think about how funny The Big Bang Theory is. He will literally lick the plate clean and fold his tray table and put it in the place where he will put it every night for the rest of his painfully lonely, fibrous, organized life. But then he got Blythe. And I know they are together. I'm not an idiot. And now it feels like I'm the one with the fucking collapsible table and the world is upside down. You should be here telling me what Blythe says about him in her stories. I need you. I need levity. I hate Ethan. I hate him for having Blythe. When we broke up, they should have broken up, and I try to be normal. I ask him what's up with him, but he feeds me bullshit. We don't want to rush into anything, and we both value our independence, so we're taking it nice and slow, you know? No, I don't know, because I don't value my independence. I value your pussy. If I were in his Reeboks, divorced, coupon-hoarding, slow, I would have put a bullet in my head. These are the darkest days in the history of the world, and I'm losing it. And as if that's not enough, he is trying to learn Spanish from listening to Enrique Iglesias songs, and he asks if he can put some on right now. Sure, I say. I don't care anymore. I am so dead that I'm deaf. I don't have to listen to it right now, he panders. Want me to play something else? I have a ton of playlists on here. I have club music and rock music and jazz music. Ethan, it's not jazz music, it's just jazz. Joe, you know so much about everything, he says, and he always finds a reason to smile. If I gave him a bloody nose, he'd find a reason to thank me. I feel like I'm learning more every day. I go downstairs and lock the door and check your email. There is a lot of junk about school, some financial bickering with your parents, your dad is helping you a little, and you're pity partying with Lynn and Hannah about the Januaries. You were trying to keep busy, buying all kinds of shit online, putting it on Daddy's credit card, then promising Daddy you'll return it. There's no way around it anymore. You are gone, shopping, and I peel the new skin off my burn and watch the pus ooze. I am not healing. I refuse to get over you. Then you write to Hannah. I am so sorry, but I am not going to be able to go to that show with you next week. It's just, well, I miss Joe. If I had a folding TV dinner tray, I would hurl it at the window and pound my chest like a barbarian, like a thick-dicked alpha gorilla. Yes! You miss me. It's true. You do. The countdown to the apocalypse is canceled, and you miss me, and I blow on my finger, and I love life, and CNC Music Factory, and maybe Ethan really will learn Spanish, and I read on. I don't know if it's him per se, or what we had, but I keep thinking about him, and I keep almost calling, and I am going to call if I don't get out of here. So I'm gonna go to Peach's place in Little Compton and just kinda decompress. And now I'm pacing, because you love me so much, you have to leave New York. It's official. You are obsessed, and you go on. So again, so sorry to bail, but Peach says you are welcome to join if you want. Hannah's response is epic, and I love her, and I love the world. She is succinct. Okay, Beck. You missed Joe, so you're running off to a deserted beach house in the dead of winter with Peach? You. I need space, Hannah.
Well, no offense, but I don't think of a peach pit as space. See you when you're back.
You miss me, and you miss me, and there's an email from Peach. Becalicious, you rule. I know you were on the verge of calling Joseph last night, and I am so proud of you for not caving. You are so talented, and you're in school. Of course that has to come first, and Joseph above anyone would want you to do what's best for you. Don't be so hard on yourself, B. Anywho, we're going to have a blast in LC. Oh, before I forget, it turns out that most of the bedrooms are mid-renovation. I hate to do this, but can you actually not invite C and L? Thanks. Bedrooms are under construction, but there is always room for one more. It's vacation time, and before you can vacate, you need to prepare. Everyone knows that. I bolt up the stairs and tell Ethan I'm going to the Gap.
Don't even look at anything in the front, he advises. Plow right on through to the back.
You're a good man, Ethan, I say, and I mean it. You'll be speaking Spanish in no time.
Thanks, Joe, or should I say, gracias. And remember, it's Tuesday.
I know, I say. All clearance items are 40% off.
You know it, Joe.
And I do. I can't wait to get new things. I like old things, but you like new things, and maybe there's something to be said for new things. You miss me. And that's new. And that's good. Chapter 30. I'm back at the shop, surrounded by newness. And maybe I'm more like you than I know, because the new things are exciting, Beck. New bandages, clean, new hat, wool, new haircut, short, and a new attitude, psyched. I'd let Ethan go home early, and he said he was happy to see me in such high spirits. It's only a matter of time before you reach out to me. You miss me. And I check your email again because the news has been so good. Hannah's laying into you about your LC tweet.
Hannah, LC? Beck, the only way you could sound like more of an asshole is if by LC you mean Lauren Conrad. You can't call it LC if you've never been there. Which you haven't, right?
You.
Okay, you're right. LC was a lame tweet. I just feel kind of off since Joe.
Hannah. If you feel off, then you should be a grown-up and call him up and see him again. Running away with Princess Peach is literally the worst thing to do.
You.
I know. It's like in Sex and the City when Carrie is in Paris with the Russian and she says she can't help but wonder what it would be like if she were there with Mr. Big.
Hannah. Except that's a bullshit TV show where they have to drag things out. This is real life. Stop being a drama queen and call him up. Who knows? Maybe he'll even go to Rhode Island for a night.
Oh, Beck, I'm gonna be there every night. This is it. Our new beginning.
You write back.
You.
That actually sounds kind of nice.
Hannah. Then do it. Invite him. Fuck Peach. You can pretend he hunted you down all romantic and shit.
You.
Maybe. Imagine if I just text him the address and say, come, LOL.
And I check my phone for a text from you. Nothing. But it's official. You want me, and it's official. I want you. I can't sit around here and wait. I have to man up, and I do. First things first, I find Peach's family address online through a combination of an old article in Architectural Digest and Google Maps. Now, I call Mr. Mooney and ask if it's okay to go on a road trip and close up for a few days. Joe, you're the boss over there now. And you know how I feel about January. It's a waste. Take a vacation. You've earned it. And I have. All the while, you've been emailing with Hannah and Lynn, who is also on Team Joe, naturally.
Lynn, so why don't you run away with him instead of Peach?
You,
please don't hate on Peach. She's going through a rough time.
Hannah, her whole life is a rough time. Next.
Lynn,
you know everything in that part of Rhode Island is closed, Beck.
You,
guys, please, it's just a weekend. It's not a big deal.
Hannah, tell her thanks for inviting me and Lynn.
Whatever.
You.
Hannah, she did invite you. She asked me to invite you.
Lynn,
that's not the same thing as a personal invitation.
You.
Guys, she's depressed. You know she has a stalker, right?
Lynn. LOLOLOLOL.
Hannah, how much is she paying him?
Lynn. LOLOLOLOL.
You.
Guys, she means well.
Hannah, of course, dollar sign, she does. Dollar sign.
Lynn. Hashtag well done, Hannah.
You. Frowny face.
I love your friends for being on my side. It means a lot to me, and one day at our wedding, I'll thank them for it. I would like to say the same for Peach, but she's not on Team Joe. She's on Team Beck, and she doesn't understand that Team Beck and Team Joe are the same team. You've also been yapping with her. Peach, almost forgot, you will die over our library. Tons of first editions, Beck. Spalding was a friend of the family. We have tons signed. So much amazing stuff. Real rare editions that you can't get anywhere. I mean, I have a signed To the Lighthouse. Virginia Woolf? Well, it's a long story. Better saved for this weekend over a bottle of Pinot. You. You know who would love that? Ugh, of course you know who would love that, frowny face. Peach, I know, sweetie. I also promise that getting out of the city will be the best distraction. You, frowny face. Yeah, I hope so. I toss your phone into the plastic Gap shopping bag. It's time to stop reading your email and start getting ready to see you. I can't wait until you break down and write to me. And I know you will. You'll be all alone in your bedroom in the beach house thinking about how much better it would be with me. You'll text me and I'll get there and you'll let me in and we'll sneak upstairs and have beach house sex. I am calm now that I know our fate. All I have to do is get to Little Compton and await your call. I lock the basement doors and turn off the lights and try to remember where I parked Mr. Mooney's car and wonder if I should take 95 the whole way. Murphy's Law exists for a reason, so the front door opens and a few latecomers shuffle inside. I call out in the friendliest tone, I hate to do this, but we're closing. I know the sounds of this shop and I have a bad feeling. I know what it sounds like when someone locks the front door, and I know what it sounds like when the open sign flips to closed. My machete is in the basement, and I am upstairs, and I hear them charging me, whoever they are. There are three of them, faceless dudes in Barack Obama masks, two big, one smaller. The smaller one wields a crowbar, and there's no time to hide in the vestibule or the basement. When you can't win, you lose, and they all come at me at once. They attack. I take it like a man, and they pound me like I'm a motherfucker, like I literally fucked their mothers. My face is mashed in blood and saliva, and it's possible that my right eye is no longer functioning. Finally, the attack ends, and I am not a man right now, just a collection of pulsing wounds. I open the eye that still works. The smallest Obama swipes my new Gap hat off the counter and pumps his fist, and... Holy fuck. I recognize those sneakers. Because I've asked Curtis to keep his dirty feet off the counter at least 100 times. So this is him, his revenge. Curtis and the other Obamas scramble for the door, and I remain on the ground, throbbing. I will not feel sorry for myself. I did have this coming. There are things I have done, bold things. I remember Benji's red badge of courage. Of course, at some point, I would have to suffer. You miss me, and I'm about to have you at last, and this is the turning point in my life, so of course there is a time for atonement. I bleed, and I swell. My left eye flutters, and I have atoned, and the closed sign is accurate. There is closure. Finally, I am free. Chapter 31. It's a long, cold drive to Little Compton. The heat in Mooney's Buick is still broken. My wool hat is gone, so I'm wearing Benji's Fugawi hat, or rather, the hat Benji stole from Spencer Hewitt, but it's canvas, not wool. At times like this, it would be nice to be rich, to have a new wool hat and a brand new SUV, and I wonder what I was thinking, leaving the key card to Benji's stolen goods in the locker. All that bounty is gonna rot until some scavenger buys the locker on a reality show. My tendency is always to sink, and this is why I need music. But I forgot my music because I have other things on my mind, like the fact that I might be fucking blind in one eye over someone as commonplace as Curtis. I'd sooner have my left nut chopped off in honor of exclamation point Ethan. I'm stuck with the radio, and there's nothing but Taylor Swift on every fucking station. She's like a famous version of you, Beck. Dates too much, falls too hard, fucks too fast, flees too hard. And I keep switching stations, but apparently Taylor Swift owns a mansion not far from LC, nowhere as far from anywhere in a state this small, and she may as well be the queen and the mayor and the princess of Rhode Island because they play her on the rock stations.
You know, I'd like to see the Foo Fighters cover some of Miss Swift's early stuff, or maybe Arcade Fire. And they played on the country stations.
Let's check out the latest single from Rhode Island's newest treasure. Y'all know who that is, right?
And they play it on the pop stations. We're never too old to feel 22, Rhode Island.
Well, fuck you, Taylor Swift. Because I never felt further away from 22 in my entire adult life. And why haven't they invented a solvent to stop highways from freezing? I'm skidding all over the fucking place.
I stop for gas and check your Twitter. You just tweeted from Mystic, Connecticut. Because you're a girl, you included a photo of Mystic Pizza.
Limo ride to Mystic for Mystic Pizza on the way to Little C for Winter Cottage Retreat. Hashtag done and done. Hashtag pepperoni. Hashtag better than sex. Hashtag beach house.
My associations with Mystic, Connecticut have nothing to do with the fucking Julia Roberts movie. Mystic is a bad place for me. I went there once with my fourth grade class on a field trip. At the time, I had a crush on a gruff, odd misfit named Maureen Grady. Mo for short. Most kids are assholes, just like most adults. So yes, a lot of people called her Ho Mo. We were with our class touring the deck of a tall ship and it was boring, so Mo and I ditched the tour and broke into the off-limits hall. In the dark, Mo told me she was going to steal my virginity. I tried to run and she pinned me down. I punched her, escaped, and told the teachers. Mo told a story too, and she was good at crying. Who do you think got sent to the fucking psychologist? To the dean's office, to the counselor with the fucking show me who touched you where doll. Not Mo Grady. But I don't dwell on the past. Mo's the fuck up now. Twice divorced paralegal with a profile on OkCupid and a Pomeranian named Gosling. Obviously, she'll be alone forever. I prefer to live in the moment, which is why I erase all thoughts of Mo and log on to Benji's Twitter and tweet, there's nothing sweeter than towny pussy, hashtag winter in Nantucket. You officially unfollow Benji, and you send him a direct message. You are dead to me. Dead. I smile. I pat myself on the back because Benji's off in heaven now, and I'm dealing with a busted defroster and wet icy snow. Living is harder than dying, Beck, and I'd give anything to eat pizza with you. I wash my hands in the bathroom at the gas station, and my face is hard to look at right now. Fucking Curtis and his goons marked me. There's a large, Halloweenish gash on my forehead and another one on my cheek. I splash cold water and I go on, just like Celine Dion's heart did back in Bridgeport. I make relatively good time to Little Compton, considering the snow and my face. My vision is blurry, and I try to watch the road with my left eye. The snow is still going when I reach the outskirts of town. I'm nervous. I don't do well in seaside havens with ice cream parlors and boat people, and I have to slow down. These bald tires can't handle the snow, and the Buick sounds like Sloth from the Goonies. The road is stronger than the Buick, and the shops are all closed, and the lights are out for the season. It's as if the entire population of Little Compton is holed up in Tay-Tay's mansion. But the animals are still on the loose. And by the time I notice the deer that's bolting across the road and slam on the brakes, it's too late. The Buick moans and rams the deer, and we are now one, flesh and steel, a tornado car wreck spiraling across the road, into the trees and through the trees. I lose time. I lose my equilibrium and close my eyes, and the smell of burnt rubber and flesh overtakes me, everything, and then nothing. When I wake up, there is only silence. The pain then branches in my lap, blocking my view. But miracles abound in the Buick. I am alive. My Fugawi hat is on my head, and my phone is intact. I was only out for 20 minutes. Wow, I say, because it has to be said. All I see are glass chips and bark and leaves. It's as if a tree ate the Buick, and for a second I fear there is no escape. I bleed into my warm clothes, but that is nothing new. I am blessed, again, because nothing in this car is electronic. I can unlock the dented door and fight my way out of this gloriously analog American-made beast. I fall into the red snow. Deer blood, my blood, yet I am alive. I check my email. You haven't tried me yet, but you will. I go to Google Maps, and we really are destined, Beck. I am destined to be with you because my phone confirms that I am 234 feet due west of Peach Salinger's home at 43 Plover's Way. But it's a hard climb back up to the street. Something bad happened to every part of my body when I hit that deer. I lift my right foot and my left leg hums. I shift my weight to my right foot, but then my right rib cage bites. I fall into the snow and just let the coolness into my clothing. Patience, Joe, I say. Patience. I crawl forward a few feet and notice two signs, partially obscured. One is a simple stop sign, universally understood. The other is prissier on a white board. Huckins Neck Beach Club, Inc. No trespassing. Members only. Keep off rocks. No jumping or diving. No lifeguards on duty. Swim at own risk. Nature is on my side because these rules don't apply in winter. A tiny security booth adjacent to the sign is very clearly closed for winter. All right, I say, and I go on. Stronger than Celine Dion's heart. Like a soldier easing out of a foxhole, I stay low to the ground. My arms are not as fucked up as my legs and my midsection. I am fully sweating with teeth chattering and eyes clear and then blurry and then clear and then blurry. But I must be there, and I recalculate the distance on my phone. I am 224 feet away. Are you kidding me? I say out loud. I've only gone 10 fucking feet. My mouth is dry, and I stuff it with snow. At this rate, I will get to you next summer. I close my eyes. I can do anything. I can do anything, and you miss me. And the hardest part will be this walk, and you could call at any moment. You could. I dig my hands into the snowy dirt, and I get some traction. I have to do a cheater's push-up for my knees, and I wince, and I sting, but I do it, Beck. I'm up. And I find a limp that works for me. A zombie sidestep, like I'm missing a conjoined twin. I check my phone, and the blue dot is on top of the red dot. I am here. Three more steps, and I've reached the driveway, and wow. This isn't a cottage, Beck. This is a mansion from a storybook about an evil seaside queen who takes all the township's money and builds an unnecessarily long driveway, ensconced in shrubbery and emptying like a river into a fuck-you-world four-car garage. The house is two stories, three if you count the widow's walk. The front yard is a clean, sparkling carpet of new white snow, and the lights flicker from inside while stars hover above, hoping to get inside. If Thomas Kincaid, painter of light, crossed brushstrokes with Edward Hopper, it would look a lot like this. And the quiet. I expected to hear the sea, but the ocean sleeps too. And I can hear snowflakes melting, branches tweaking. Am I always this loud? My breathing is too raspy, and what if you can hear inside that cottage? I step backward instinctively. I hear a drop of blood plop into the weak new snow. I can't leave tracks. Peach will think her stalker is back and call in the National Guard. I don't want to scare you, so I head east to case the house next door. We're in luck, Beck. The neighbors don't share the Salinger family's passion for landscaping. This property is lush, overgrown with trees, and the snow isn't a clean sheet for me to disturb. This is a quiet most people will die never knowing. And then a shriek. Peach yells, Beck! I duck. But I can tell by her screaming that you are heeding the call, running to the west wing of the cottage. This is my chance, and I bolt to the east-facing wall and allow myself a look inside the great room. That's what rich people call living rooms. It's huge. A giant nautical blue sectional winds like a fat, loving snake. The coffee table is repurposed lobster traps welded together and topped with glass. And it's aglow thanks to the flames crackling in the fireplace. When I hear you laugh, I am at last sure that I'm not dead. Smoke sails out of the chimney, and no wonder Taylor Swift bought a house here. I can hear the Elton John. Peach really is on vacation, replacing her morose, vaguely suicidal running ballad with the slightly cheekier self-indulgence of Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. Oh, and I can smell the marijuana. I crouch as you breeze into the room. The seaside suits you, and God, do I miss you. You stand before the fireplace with your legs apart as if you're about to be patted down. You are as lit as the fire, alive. in black leggings and that gray sweater you wore to work the day we had sex. When you bend slightly to warm your hands over the fire, I have an uncontrollable urge to jump through the window and enter you. But Peach plods into the room and ruins the scene and offers you a glass of wine, typical, and you sip it, and she goes back to the kitchen. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a roofie in there. You miss me, and I miss you. It hurts, seeing you at that fire, giving your hands to the heat, the way I gave my hand to fire, only different. I imagine pushing you into the red abyss and jumping in after you, with you, so we can burn together forever. A tree of life, light, sex. And of course, Peach plods into the room again and tells you dinner will be ready in an hour. She wants to play gin rummy. Is she 85 years old? And you obey your hostess and join her on the giant sectional sofa. My hands are numb, and yet aching, and it's too cold to stay here. I'm not an animal, and what is my plan? I realized that I drove here with dreams, not plans. My dream, you text me. I pretend I'm in New York